Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have a fabulous show for you today. I have with me Dr. Tyler Jones, and we are going to talk about the two really interesting topics of SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, kind of the myths and truths about those. And Tyler is a fabulous guest. So he works at Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles. He teaches CRNA students there, and he recently became board certified in obesity medicine, which is really fascinating, and maybe he'll tell us a little bit about that. And he's going to split his practice between that and anesthesia. He doesn't have any disclosures, but he does have this really fabulous blog called Anesthesia Thoughts, and he talks about kind of, and Tyler, I'll let you tell us a little more, but really interesting things that maybe people have misconceptions about or that are maybe a little practice not in the way the evidence might suggest. And so that, I find it really interesting and really, really worth a visit to his blog. And then we're going to talk about two of those things today. So Tyler, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chad.
Tell me a little bit about how you got started with the blog, Anesthesia Thoughts.
I've long had a passion for education for myself and for other people, and keeping up on the literature is pretty difficult because there are more studies published every month than any one of us can read. And quite frankly, most of these articles that come out are not super relevant to the day-to-day practice of anesthesia. It's really important to do a lot of investigation into smaller things like how anesthesia works, but to try to sift between articles like that and an article about a new pain medication that I could use every day in my practice is difficult. So part of my impetus to start the blog was to try to sift through that noise myself and then bring papers that everyday anesthesiologists can use every day.
Yeah, fabulous. I think that is one of the things I've noticed about your blog that I really like is that it is absolutely something that I think any anesthesiologist, no matter what their kind of background in digging through the literature is, they can really get a lot out of it. So I think you're doing a fabulous job there. Tell me a little bit about the decision to do this board certification in obesity medicine. I don't know that I've seen that before. What was that process and what made you do it?
Yeah, right now the process is you can either do a one-year fellowship and take the exam, or you can go through a CME pathway where you have to do certain accredited courses of 60 CME hours and then take the exam. Both result in you being board certified. My desire to do this was stemmed from I have a big interest in preventive medicine, and I've spent a lot of time reading about that through the recent years. So this, to me, was a way to kind of branch out and be able to split my practice to do a little more that in obesity medicine is not necessarily strictly preventive medicine, but to get into that field and give myself a little more variety as opposed to just being in the operating room every single day for the rest of my career.
Very cool. All right. Well, that's awesome. And I'm sure people can look into that if they're interested in learning more about it. So let's talk about these two really interesting topics. Let's start with SGLT2 inhibitors. So tell me a little bit about what they are, just maybe even to spell out that acronym just for people who don't know what it means, and then how they work.
Yeah. So the SGLT2 inhibitors are a class of drugs that originally were for treating diabetes. They caused the kidneys to reabsorb less glucose. And now they're being prescribed for multiple indications for cardiac patients with heart failure and for patients with chronic kidney disease. And occasionally they're even used off-label for weight loss, although that is a pretty small effect. So we're seeing these medications more and more now, in particular because of the cardiac benefits. A lot of patients are being put on them. Because of the mechanism of action, they lead to lower insulin and then higher glucagon, which promotes ketogenesis. So insulin, getting a little into the biochemistry, higher levels of insulin act as a negative feedback to inhibit ketogenesis. And the problem with these drugs is by having lower levels, you have an increased risk of developing ketones. So it's pretty clear in the literature that patients taking these have a higher risk of ketoacidosis. And that can be from a number of factors. Typically, if people are just living their day-to-day lives, that risk is very minimal. But the risk increases when people have these acute stressors, such as an infection, if they're fasting for some reason, if they have surgery. And this is where the concern comes on our end with anesthesia is, do these medications increase the risk of ketoacidosis during surgery?
And I think that the teaching, right, I mean, certainly what a lot of people are told and believe right now is that they absolutely do, that these people on these medicines are much more likely to have euglycemic DKA during and the perioperative period, right? I mean, that's kind of what people believe.
Yeah, so I think we should just clarify some terminology. These medications definitely increase the risk of ketoacidosis. Whether that is euglycemic or diabetic ketoacidosis is a little bit just about definitions. If someone's glucose is above 200 and they're diabetic, then we would define that as diabetic ketoacidosis. But because a lot of people are taking these not for diabetes, they may have euglycemic. Either way, it's a little bit of a semantic approach because ketoacidosis is ketoacidosis, whether or not the sugar is high, and it still can be harmful. We've had multiple studies now and some meta-analysis showing that these do have a higher incidence of ketoacidosis just in the general population. The FDA came out a few years ago and recommended that we hold these medications for 3 to 4 days before surgery due to a concern of surgery promoting the ketoacidosis from these. And I think that was a good recommendation. At the time, we didn't have some of the studies that we now do. So it's always good to operate out of an abundance of caution until we have more evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. So you've defined these two things, right, that essentially are the same. I think that the one of the tricky things about euglycemic DKA is that our typical way of being concerned that someone might be in DKA is that they have a high glucose level. So if, in fact, they do not, then we may not think about it. So important to think about it.
Exactly.
And do we know? I mean, so you've answered the question, do these drugs make you more at risk for DKA? Yes. Does it matter whether you, I guess the big question is, does it matter whether you hold the medication or not before surgery? Because that's really, we're not going to refuse to do surgery on someone who's ever been on one of these. So the question is, how do we handle people coming in for surgery who are prescribed these medications, right?
Right. So that's the big question. And there are a few papers that have come out. They are all retrospective studies. So we don't have randomized controlled trials at the moment to show us whether we have an increased risk from taking these medications or holding them before surgery. But looking at this retrospective data, we start to see that maybe the concern about diabetic or euglycemic ketoacidosis with surgery is not as big of a concern as we once thought. And we also have some signals that there could even be benefits in continuing these medications. So I can get into one of these studies. This is a retrospective study. And the authors looked at patients who had diabetes, were taking SGLT2 inhibitors, and were undergoing one of several emergency surgeries. The emergency surgery is because this was a retrospective study. They wanted to assume that patients were probably still taking these medications as opposed to elective surgery where they've been held. So given this is a retrospective study, we have plenty of limitations. One way that the authors tried to control for the patients taking SGLT2 inhibitors is they made sure that they had a pharmacy refill within a certain amount of time that they could still have doses left when they were admitted and undergoing surgery. What they found was a 3.8% increase in the incidence of diabetic ketoacidosis in the SGLT2 inhibitor group and a 3.5% in the matched controls. So there's no statistically significant difference between those groups. So I think it's important.
So yeah, no, just to clarify. So the in this retrospective study, they did not find any difference between the people who they, as far as they could tell, were taking SGLT2s and those who didn't.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, when we were talking about the definitions, these authors looked at using ICD-10 codes for both diabetic ketoacidosis and acidosis. Unfortunately, there's no ICD-10 code for euglycemic ketoacidosis, so that limits the ability to do some of these studies. Now, because they looked at both diabetic ketoacidosis and acidosis, there is a concern that they were capturing patients who may not have been in ketoacidosis. In the sensitivity analysis, they excluded just the regular acidosis ICD-10 code and found no difference in the results. So I think this is a pretty well done retrospective study showing that there was no major difference between the incidence between groups.
So when we think about this, this suggests that actually these medications, at least in this study, did not cause an increased risk of DKA.
Yeah, that's what this is suggesting.
Okay. And this was not about whether they held it or not. This was just about if they thought they were on it, did it matter?
Right. Right. It seems fairly pragmatic because it's limited to emergency surgeries. But again, we don't have that crystal clear evidence we'd love to have of an RCT knowing that patients either did or didn't take the medications.
Okay. What else do we know?
So we have a couple other studies looking at this. I think one is interesting for me to highlight because this is the sort of study that I see all the time, and it gives you some evidence, and I think people may read it and think a certain thought, but when you delve deeper into the study details, I think it's not as clear as one may hope. So this is another retrospective study, interestingly enough, published in the same journal in the same month as the one I was just describing, and this study looked at patients taking SGLT2 inhibitors and compared them to controls similarly, but their primary outcome was defined differently. So their primary outcome was defined as having an elevated anion gap acidosis defined by certain lab values of base excess or bicarbonate and having a glucose less than 200 and a lactate less than 3 millimoles. This study did not restrict their results to a DKA code, and they weren't measuring ketones. So immediately my concern with this is that we may be over-capturing patients rather than just restricting them to our outcome of interest. So what this study found is they showed an increased incidence of acidosis in the patients taking SGLT2 inhibitors. However, when you look at the incidence, the overall incidence was about 30% in the SGLT2 group and 28% in the controls. So it's a huge difference compared to that prior study that found the incidence was around 3.5%. So again, my thought goes to a concern that they may be significantly over-capturing this event because it was not narrowly defined enough in the primary outcome.
Right. So they may have been, must have been capturing other acidoses that were not diabetic ketoacidosis, because it's really hard to believe that 1/3 of both the patients and the controls were getting DKA.
Exactly. And when they restricted their results to just emergency surgeries, you see those numbers go up to 46% in the SGLT2 group and 42% in the controls. So again, I love having more information, but this is a study where I have enough concerns about the methodology that I'm not really sure what to do with this data.
Yeah, sounds fair. Okay. So that study may be less helpful.
Right. Maybe less helpful. And this is the thing. Research is not easy to do. And if I was I'm not someone who does primary research myself, but if I was giving anyone advice, I'd say try to be very clear with your primary outcomes so that we get useful data, because having data that is confusing can be almost more confusing to everyone than not having done the study in the first place.
Right. Yes, I agree with that. And, you know, it's right. When you look closely and you think 30%, you know, that, and you know, there's no way one out of every three patients who is not even on these medicines is getting DKA, then that it's, but if you just quickly look and you see the abstract and it just says, oh, there's a higher risk of acidosis, you know, that you draw a different conclusion. So I agree with you. You have to be careful with the study because people might just very quickly look at it and draw conclusions from that.
Right. Right. So there's one more paper that I think is interesting with these SGLT2 inhibitors. And this is a paper looking at patients who are undergoing cardiopulmonary bypass surgery. Now, these patients, they did have the dose the day before surgery, but they did not have the dose the morning of surgery. Again, this is a retrospective study looking at the outcomes between these patients. And notably, this study was not looking at the incidence of ketoacidosis in either group. what they were looking at was seeing if there was a difference in a composite outcome of cardiac events in the patients taking SGLT2 inhibitors. We know these medications in a chronic timeline have a protective effect on the heart, and that's why they're prescribed for a lot of patients with heart failure. So they wanted to see if there was an acute protection with these medications. Patients did have the med, you know, held the morning of surgery, but we'll see the primary outcome. It was defined as a composite of events looking at an increase in high sensitivity troponins. They were also looking at low cardiac output syndrome defined as requiring inotropes for 48 hours or mechanically circulatory support. And then they also looked at 30-day mortality. What they saw was that this outcome occurred in about 27% of SGLT2 inhibitor patients compared with 42% of controls. So that's a pretty significant difference between those groups. Notably, the majority of this outcome was driven by a difference in elevations in the high sensitivity troponin.
Yeah. Okay, so this is really interesting. So the people who were on the SGLT2 inhibitor had quite a striking decrease in a troponin rise after surgery.
Right.
So what conclusion do we draw from that? Probably that these are protective. These are cardioprotective, as we know.
Right. So we know they have a chronic cardioprotective benefit. Maybe they also have an acute cardioprotective benefit. This is inferred by the elevations or lack thereof with troponin, myocardial injury. And there's definitely a question of how much injury is normal, acceptable, because I think there's this growing concern looking at myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery and measuring patients' troponins. And some of this data, this is actually something I'd like to look into more and probably write a post on in the future, but some of this data suggests that maybe even 20% of our patients going for normal surgery have an elevation in troponin. So what is clinically significant here to me is not super clear. However, I think this is worth giving us pause and saying, okay, we have some evidence that suggests holding these medications may not actually reduce ketoacidosis. And now we have some evidence that suggests continuing these medications may offer some benefit. So that's what gives me pause when we are looking at updating our thoughts on this recommendation from the FDA.
Yeah. And what's interesting to think about, too, is, as you mentioned, there may be some differences in these groups. You could imagine that the group on SGLT2 inhibitors, the fact that they're on them might indicate they have better primary care or that they are, I don't know what insurance coverage is like for these, but maybe they are able to afford these out of pocket. And so they have more wealth. And with that, they're able to have better overall health care. So you could imagine there might be ways in which the SGLT2 inhibitor is a marker for something else that's not being measured.
Absolutely. These drugs are still fairly expensive. And we know that having a higher income is correlated with having better health outcomes. All these studies are retrospective, so plenty of confounders can be here.
Yeah.
Another thought with this paper did not look at the instance of ketoacidosis. However, we know that a lot of patients going into the ICU have very tight glycemic control, often managed with insulin infusions. And as I said before, insulin will suppress that ketogenesis risk. So giving these patients insulin could have prevented any ketoacidosis. The authors didn't look at this, but it's just something to keep in mind and say, well, the subset of patients that benefited could be different because they're receiving a different level of care that maybe mitigated any risk from continuing these medications.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense.
So I think one thing is people might be asking, well, where do we go from here? Because we have this recommendation and what can we do about it with these medications? Should we continue them? Should we not continue them? I don't have a clear answer to that because it'd be great to have better data. Some hospital systems have developed some protocols for avoiding canceling these patients if they take the medication beforehand. So the way that a couple of these systems have done this is by measuring beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is one of the main ketones in the blood, in the pre-op setting. So a patient comes in, they say they'd continue their medication, you don't want to cancel a surgery, you could check a serum ketone level and see, is it elevated, is it not? We don't have randomized controlled trial data showing what to do with this, but we can infer based on ketone levels and what we know about risk from other studies to say, if the levels below a certain point, maybe it's safe to proceed with surgery.
Okay. And is that cutoff set at differently at different hospitals, or is there kind of a generally accepted level?
Yeah, so there's one paper that looked at this, and they used examples from Northwell Health System and another hospital system. They both set the levels slightly differently, but they were using cutoffs of between 1.5 and 2.0 millimoles. Typically, the risk for ketoacidosis is cited as occurring at or above 3 millimoles. And just for reference, when people are doing a ketogenic diet, they are said to be in ketosis at 0.5 millimoles. So that risk, that level of 1.5 or 2 is allowing for some ketosis, but not a significant amount. I'd say if somebody is below half a millimole, then the risk is probably very low. But you always want to consider the other factors. Is this patient going to be eating after surgery? Is going to be the most significant factor.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if they're 1.5 to 2, they're getting higher than you probably should be just from a keto diet, and therefore, you know, you may be worried that they're at higher risk for going into actual DKA.
Exactly. So above those levels, definitely the concern for, do we need to do the surgery right now, or could we manage these patients and then do the surgery the next day or when the ketone levels are lower?
Okay. So what in the end, let me ask you this, make sure I have this correct. In general, not around surgery, just in general, people on SGLT2 inhibitors do have a higher risk of DKA than patients not on them, right? That we do know.
Right.
Okay. But there's not a lot of data on what happens perioperatively. And the little bit that we have that we talked about are some retrospective studies, one of which showed no increased risk and one of which showed an increased risk of some acidosis, but that included a lot more than just diabetic ketoacidosis or even ketoacidosis. So it's unclear what to make of that one. So really, we don't have a great feel for what the risk perioperatively of being on these or of holding them or not. So what should we tell patients, do you think, about whether to hold their SGLT2 inhibitor or not? And sorry, I should add that you mentioned there's a study suggesting that it may be in the immediate post-op period cardioprotective to have taken it. So we have to take that into account as well.
Right. I think that based on our retrospective data, we have enough evidence to question the benefit of holding these. But you to say to any one individual that they should just be fine going ahead with surgery is not a good recommendation. I think that the best thing to do before we have an RCT to show us some better information is to have hospitals develop policies. Ideally, we could develop policies to check these ketone levels in the periop period so that we can avoid canceling these cases. And that could be seen as a QI measure of cost saving. We're not canceling these surgeries. We're helping these patients out. There are a few other points, I think, that just suggest maybe this risk is not as high as we think. And that's by eating, you're decreasing the risk of being in ketoacidosis. And many places now, including the place I work, are telling patients to have a carbohydrate beverage 2 hours before surgery. So that right there is going to decrease the risk of them being in ketosis if they drank their 8 ounces of apple juice. And then most of these patients are eating after surgery. You know, with many surgeries, patients are eating after, I would say, depending on what it is. So you can keep that in mind. So if you have those factors working toward you, then again, maybe the risk of ketoacidosis is not as high. But what exactly we need to do with this information should be dependent on the hospital. You develop a policy within your group that says, we still recommend holding these based on the FDA recommendation, but if patients forgot to hold it, we have this protocol that lets us kind of rescue that.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, we also, where I've seen it, and this is a function of the fact that I work in the ICU, but is patients who are having major surgery and they're not going to eat or have any nutrition for a while post-op. They go to the ICU, they're still intubated, right? Those are the patients who I would think might be at higher risk because they have nothing. They're not getting food. They're not getting it. So, you know, maybe we have to be more careful with those patients as opposed to the patient who's going to start eating a few hours after surgery.
Exactly. If you stop eating, most people are going to go into ketosis within 1 to 2 days, no matter what. So being on these medications definitely increases that risk. If you knew someone wasn't going to be eating after surgery, I would absolutely want them holding these medications ahead of time.
So I think what I have taken from this discussion is that we need more data. We definitely don't have a great amount of evidence to suggest that we should or shouldn't be telling patients to hold these. But in the absence of a lot of evidence and in the presence of at least some reassuring data, maybe we should not routinely be canceling cases if patients don't hold them. Maybe we select certain patients who we might want to think about that with if they're at particularly high risk, but it doesn't, there's not at least a lot of evidence to suggest we should be canceling cases routinely because patients didn't hold them.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey folks, hunger strikes and you're exhausted. There's something healthy in your fridge that you should be making, but you just don't have it in you. Sound familiar? For me, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem, it's a setup problem, until I found Factor. Factor solves the setup problem with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs delivered right to your door. My wife and I want to give our kids healthy food that they will actually eat, but we don't have time to cook from scratch. That's why we use Factor, and you should too. Inside your Factor box, you'll find lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole food ingredients, and healthy fats. It's always fresh, never frozen. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Over 100 rotating weekly meals, including globally inspired flavors like Mediterranean and Asian, so there's always something new to look forward to. Try the newly launched ready-to-eat salads with vibrant ingredients like elote corn and miso edamame. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and free daily greens per box. With new subscription only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details. Hey folks, this time of year always makes me rethink what's in my closet. I'm trying to keep fewer things, but better ones, pieces that are well made and easy to wear all the time. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense. Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials like 100% European linen and their insanely soft flow-knit activewear fabric. Their men's linen pants and shirts are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, basically the perfect layer for spring. And their flow-knit activewear, moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. The best part is that their prices are 50 or 60% less than similar brands. How? Because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince. I wear it all the time, and it might be the only thing my wife and daughters actually compliment me on. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/ACCRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for Austin humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout. All right, and we're back.
Right. That's pretty much where I'm at with this. I think if someone shows up for their endoscopy or colonoscopy and they didn't hold the medication, well, is that risk of I'm going to cancel the surgery and they're going to eat right now, or I'm going to do the colonoscopy and they're going to eat 45 minutes from now, that's probably not what's going to push them into ketoacidosis or not. And I think this data is pretty reassuring for that patient. You know, the patient who's getting colorectal surgery, not eating, that's a different story.
Yeah. Okay, great. So let's move to GLP-1 receptor agonists. Obviously, this is a really hot topic. There's so many people on these, more and more. Now there's a pill, so there's going to be even more people on these. So how do these work?
Yeah, this is such a hot topic. And fortunately, I'm going to be able to give you some better guidance based on the evidence with these medications of what to do, although controversy will certainly still exist.
Of course.
So these medications, the primary mechanism by which they work is by slowing gastric emptying with the GLP-1 receptor. There seem to be some other mechanisms that are a little less well teased out, because we're seeing evidence that patients who have addictions to food, for example, or alcohol or smoking, when they go on these medications, are losing their cravings for those substances. So there's probably some neural mechanism that's also working to decrease food consumption in these patients. But overall, these work by making people feel full so they eat less food. Because that delayed gastric emptying, this is the biggest concern for us as anesthesiologists, or one of the biggest concerns with aspiration. And we're thinking about this every single time we induce people, the whole reason we have our fasting guidelines. So if these medications are increasing, you know, residual gas, they're delaying gastric emptying, they're increasing residual gastric contents, we want to know, what should we do to manage that risk?
Yeah.
This initially came about because there were some case studies where patients were aspirating and had increased gastric volumes. A lot of this research was done in endoscopies, where it was very easy to see that these patients had residual gastric contents. So a few years ago, the ASA released their first recommendations, and those have since been revised. Both the ASA and the British Association have guidelines. So I'd like to go through those and just touch on what the most recent guidelines say.
Great.
So the ASA, the most recent guidelines, they recommend a couple different points. The first one being, they give a whole bunch of parameters by which you can potentially risk stratify these patients to say, okay, does this person have an increased risk of having residual gastric contents and therefore aspirating? If a patient does not meet any of these criteria, they say the GLP-1 receptor agonist may be continued in patients without elevated risk of gastric emptying. Now, we're going to get into this in a little bit, but unfortunately, there's no way to use their criteria to decide who has an elevated risk or not. The second part of their guideline says we can give consideration using shared decision-making to consider a liquid diet for 24 hours, consider gastric ultrasound, consider rapid sequence intubation. So that's the ASA guideline.
And as you said, the big issue here, I think you mentioned, is that saying you can continue them if they're not elevated risk means you have to know who's elevated risk, and that's not easy to figure out.
Exactly. We'll get into this a little more, but the only way to clearly know whether someone has residual gastric contents is to do imaging. And the only really feasible way to do that is gastric ultrasound. Unfortunately, that's not widespread right now. It's a great decision point, but if I'm going to talk to the mass of anesthesiologists in this country, it's hard for me to give that as a recommendation because it is fairly new.
Right.
So the British guidelines, they're similar. The big difference between the British recommendations and the ASA ones are that the British recommendations recommend continuing the GLP-1 receptor agonists. I should go back and say the first edition of the ASA recommendation said to hold one dose of these GLP-1 receptor agonists before surgery, with the hope that this would alleviate some of the delayed gastric emptying. So the British recommendations say there's no point in holding a dose. These patients should just be continued on it. They say specifically that GI symptoms alone should not be used to determine the risk of residual gastric contents. They also recommend continuing gastric ultrasound. They also recommend using, considering RSI, using prokinetics that may reduce the gastric contents. They do not recommend a longer fasting duration. So similar, but a little different between the two guidelines.
Yeah, and that's an important point, right, is that there are a couple of, if we think that these people being on these medications have slower gastric emptying, which I think that's pretty clear that they do, then the question is, do we have them stop the medication and hope, therefore, that they have faster gastric emptying? Or do we have them fast for longer, and therefore, eventually, their stomach will empty, or something else, right? But those seem like the two major choices if we want to reduce risk.
Exactly. So I'm going to paint a picture that is clearly in favor of one of those answers.
Okay.
So what does the evidence show? The evidence is very clear that holding one dose of the medication does not affect the residual gastric contents. In fact, a study came out just a few weeks ago that looked at this in a very clear way. We've had quite a few studies looking at this. This one is the best one I've seen so far. I'll just briefly go through this. They use gastric ultrasound on patients who are on semaglutide, which is also called Ozempic and Wegovy, coming in for elective surgery. And they were following the routine fasting guidelines, and they were also told to hold one dose before surgery. So they imaged all of these patients, and then they matched them to controls based on the BMI and or diabetes status, depending on what indication they were on the medication for. They had a total of 44 patients in each group. So not a huge study, but very well done. And what they found was 49% of the patients in the semaglutide group had residual gastric contents compared to 18% of the controls. Now, they broke that down further. If you were just looking at solid contents, 42% in the semaglutide group versus 7% in the controls. And most significantly, the median fasting duration in these patients was 14 to 15 hours between the two groups. So much longer than the recommended 8 hours, and still almost half of patients had residual gastric contents.
Okay.
They, again, this is a small study, but they looked at different dosing regimens because it's one of the concerns and thoughts has been that patients taking higher doses, patients being on the medications for a shorter amount of time, and patients taking the drugs that last longer. So for example, semaglutide that's dosed weekly versus the pill that's dosed daily, that those increase the risk of having residual gastric contents. And they found no association between that. So even patients who had been on these medications for up to 4 years had some full stomach. So what this shows is we can't determine whether or not these patients have residual gastric contents without imaging them. And that a large number of these patients will have residual gastric contents when following the 8-hour typical fasting guidelines. Now, I've heard a lot of people say, well, there's no harm in holding one dose of the medication. And to that, I'd like to try to paint a picture that there is potential harm in holding these medications. I've given you reasons why I think there's no benefit to that. I think the biggest harm in holding one dose is that we give ourselves some false reassurance that these patients are safe to undergo anesthesia without RSI, that or undergo MAC cases without a protected airway. However, there are potential patient harms. If they're on these medications for their glucose control, they may have worse glucose control leading up to surgery. Once patients miss two or more doses of these medications, they start to have less tolerance for the side effects. And this means that they often need to decrease to a lower dose and then titrate back up. The way these medications are typically dosed is you'll start at the lowest dose, and every 4 or more weeks, you will increase the dose incrementally. And this helps patients tolerate the side effects of the nausea, the vomiting, the gastric distension, abdominal pain. So if somebody has held this dose for a week and then suddenly their surgery is rescheduled and now they're off it for another week, this can have real consequences to the patients, especially if they need to go and get a lower dose from the pharmacy. Maybe their insurance doesn't cover it. So I'm painting a picture that there are potential harms from holding these medications. And in the setting of no benefit, I think it's really clear that we should hold these medications. However, that doesn't absolve us from the bigger issue of what do we do with these residual gastric volume.
Right. And the other issue, right, is that if you wanted to really get some of these medications that are dosed weekly out of their system, you'd have to hold, you'd have to hold more than one dose, right? These things have a very long half-life.
Exactly. When we're looking at semaglutide, which is the most commonly used one, 5 doses would need to be held. So we're talking 5 weeks if you're dosing the weekly version. I haven't seen any studies that show doing this actually will absolve our residual gastric contents. This is based on the pharmacologic data, the mechanistic data. So that is one potential option. But again, I would want to see some evidence that that clearly is effective. And if you're doing that, these patients, if they're on it for weight loss, we know even in that short amount of time, they'll start to regain the weight. And then diabetics obviously would need another medication to control their blood glucose.
Right. Okay. So if we have a study suggesting that even after 12 to 14 hours of fasting, they still have a significantly higher amount of gastric contents, and we think maybe holding one dose isn't really going to matter, and there may be downsides to holding a dose or more, then what are our other options? Fast longer?
Yeah. So there's another consensus paper. This is not from the ASA. This is a paper by Apria and colleagues, and they represent the Society for Perioperative Assessment and Quality Improvement. They put out a very detailed paper, and I recommend anyone who's really interested in this go and read their paper, because it goes through the mechanisms that of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, the data from many different studies about residual gastric contents, aspiration risk, and then they offer their recommendations. So in their paper, they only found one study that showed patients clearly did not have any residual gastric contents. And this was when patients were fasted from solid food for 24 hours. There were 57 subjects in the study, and 100% of them had no residual gastric contents after fasting from solid for 24 hours. So this is the only evidence that we have showing that we can eliminate gastric contents, and it's a 24-hour fast. In their study, many other papers with patients fasting 8, 12, 14, 16 hours all had some amount of residual gastric contents.
Okay, so it sounds like it is, at least from these studies, it is possible to get the stomach to empty, but it takes 24 hours, not 12, 14, 16.
Exactly. So we would be doing for everyone on these drugs more or less what we're doing for patients undergoing colonoscopies, where you can't have solid food for a while. Now you could still be having your carbohydrate beverages, but that's going to not be a pleasant thing for people undergoing surgery if everyone is fasting for 24 hours from solids.
Right. And so then, you know, the other important point here is solids versus liquid. So, you know, what is the, if we say maybe you have to fast for 24 hours from solids, what about liquids? And does it matter? Is there a difference?
That's where we don't have clear evidence. Because all the studies that have looked at this have not separated by just solids and liquids, we don't have a clear answer. In their paper, they recommended a 4 to 8 hour liquid fast duration. So they specified that if the carbohydrate content was less than 10%, they'd like people fasting from liquids for 4 hours. And if it was 10% or more, then 8 hours. And this is just based on expert opinion.
Okay. So we don't really know how much liquid is safe, or now what about liquid content in the stomach? Like, do we know how much gastric content of liquid increases aspiration risk?
Yeah. So this is where the data gets really interesting. And I think that this idea of trying to question our prior beliefs can be really important. I think no one would question the idea that solids are increasing the risk of aspiration. And if you aspirate on solids, that's definitely going to be more harmful than aspirating just on clear liquids. But this idea that liquid residual gastric contents, how much increases aspiration risk, is the crux question to me in these patients. And to give some evidence about this, I'd reference a study that's not done in patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists. Over in Europe, many of the pediatric guidelines are recommending pediatric patients only fast for 1 hour. Now, pediatrics are certainly different than adults, so I want to hesitate to extrapolate all of this data to adults. But I use this as an example to say maybe we should be questioning how much liquid residual gastric contents are meaningful. This study analyzed three different groups of pediatric patients. It was prospective, multi-center, with a total of about 300,000 patients. And the groups were divided as patients were in the sip till send group, where they were encouraged to have liquids right up until they were going back for surgery. Then there was the 1 hour fasting from liquids and the 2 hour fasting from liquids groups. This is designed as a non-inferiority study, and they found no difference in aspiration events between the three groups of patients. So this would suggest that consuming liquids before surgery, say this is just water that we're consuming, is probably not harmful, and having some amount of liquid residual gastric contents in the stomach may not be as bad as we have thought it is. But again, this is a pediatric study. And I'm not suggesting that we can use this exact same data to extrapolate to dolphin GLP-1 receptor agonists, but I'd like to use this as a stepping point to say, well, what amount of liquid residual gastric contents is harmful in adults? And I'm not sure we know the answer to that question.
Yeah. Okay. So in the absence of knowing that for sure, what do you think the safest approach is for these patients?
I think that the best available evidence we have would suggest the safest approach is to have these patients fast for 24 hours. If you are at a center where you can do gastric ultrasound on these patients, I would highly recommend doing it on all of these patients unless they fasted from solids for 24 hours. And then you can use your decision tree from there. However, if you're going to do gastric ultrasound on these patients and then you see that they have a full stomach, it still is going to be a risk that you take on as an anesthesiologist if you're proceeding with an elective surgery, especially if it's a MAC case and you weren't planning on intubating them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's tricky. And so, you know, it's almost, there's got to be some percentage of people who will have, I guess there's a couple things. I mean, some people may have a false positive, right? Where it's the ultrasound is misread. And so they then have, they're either told they have higher risk or maybe even have their surgery canceled or delayed unnecessarily. And then there's going to be people who have contents in their stomach who aren't going to aspirate. And so then what, you know, that they may get their case delayed, even though it wasn't going to have any downside for them. And then you have, of course, people who are at higher or might aspirate or will aspirate if they go forward. And so it's a little tricky, right? How do you ultrasound everyone? And if you do ultrasound everyone, how do you act on that? So what do you think? I mean, where do we go?
Yeah, I think this is a difficult question to answer because just to take a step back and look at these patients on GLP-1s, the studies looking at whether these patients have a higher aspiration incidence are not clear. Most of the studies have not shown a higher incidence of aspiration. Some have, most haven't. And we always have the issue of studying rare events. So maybe they truly don't have a higher risk of aspiration, but that's really hard to show because rare events are hard to study. I think we have to ask ourselves, well, what is the risk that we're willing to take on? Do we want aspiration events to be zero, or is there some really small percent that is acceptable to balance the inconvenience to patients of fasting for longer durations, et cetera? I think we need to ask clinically, what is the significance of a certain amount of liquid residual gastric contents? And does that increase aspiration rates? This pediatric study would suggest that it probably doesn't. So these aren't easy questions to answer. I would just want people to take home, don't be reassured if a patient holds a dose of these medications. That's not reassuring to me because they could still have residual gastric contents. I would say if you're going to use an airway, it's probably better to use an ET tube than a supraglottic airway. And I'd be very cautious doing MAC cases on these patients. That being said, I'm not sure what the best thing is. All these patients coming in and say they're getting their knee replacements under spinal and MAC. You know, we have a lot of data now, and you'd think that if there was a really big signal of these patients aspirating, we'd see it. But again, it's hard to show rare events. And the other thing that I think is really insightful to me is that we see a higher amount of residual gastric contents in a lot of these patients who are not on the medications, but who have diabetes and obesity. And so maybe we need to take a step back and reevaluate how we're approaching those patients as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is really interesting. And, you know, one thing to think about, as you said, is would it make sense to have longer fasting requirements for these patients? Yes, nobody wants to fast for 24 hours, but people do it for colonoscopies. So, you know, it's not like unheard of. And if you could have clear liquid, that makes it, you know, significantly less onerous. And even a 24-hour water-only fast is not the end of the world. So if that makes it safer. So it sounds like there, you know, this is another area where ideally we'd have some more studies that look at things like longer fasts and gastric contents, that look at risk of aspiration with either different lengths of fasting or with people who hold or don't hold these medications. Because as you pointed out, it's not a risk-free thing. Holding one or multiple doses of these medicines have risks for patients as well.
Yeah. And I think we often approach medicine in this sort of binary way where we don't think about the risks of not making a decision, or we only think about the risks of holding these medications, sorry, of continuing these medications, but we don't think about the risks of holding these medications. And everything has risks on both sides. Our job as anesthesiologists in so many ways is to manage as many risks as we can, but getting to zero risk is not realistic. So where we draw that line is definitely a place that even in the best evidence, people are going to debate.
Yeah. All right. Well, lots of great stuff to think about, and you've broken this down really well. Let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something you would recommend the audience check out for fun?
All right. I have a few recommendations, Jeb. I'm a big cook. I love making dinner. And there's nothing more important to me in the kitchen than having really sharp knives. I've gone to my friends' houses and seen how dull their knives are. And I am now that person who will sharpen my friends' knives so that they have good knives. So I use this Chef's Choice electric knife sharpener. It is gold for me in the kitchen. About once a quarter, I take all my knives, sharpen them. It's really quick if you're consistent with this, and it makes a world of difference, especially when you're slicing things like tomatoes and all the soft produce. So
no, I could not agree with you more. Is this the one that has the three slots?
The three slots, yeah.
I have it too.
Two different ones typically because Western knives and Asian knives tend to have a different angle of cut, so you can get whichever one fits your knives. It is so good.
Totally agree. It makes such a difference to have nice sharp knives. Couldn't agree more.
And then I'll give a book recommendation as well. One of my favorite books is called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. It's by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. This is a great book that touches on some of the ideas that we've talked in this conversation about questioning your beliefs, cognitive biases and fallacies and cognitive dissonance and why people end up going down these, you know, rabbit holes of persisting in their beliefs despite evidence or making choices that are continuing to cause further harm, even though they don't think of themselves as that sort of person.
Awesome. Sounds great. Thank you for those recommendations. And we'll include those in the show notes along with the studies that Tyler mentioned earlier. My recommendation is a fun one. So Dr. Maria Gosling is a CA3 resident at the University of Miami. She's soon going to be a pediatric anesthesia fellow, and she wrote a children's book to empower kids undergoing anesthesia. It's fabulous. It is called Toby's Magic Bubbles, an anesthesia story. And I read it. It's really fun. It's about a fish who's having surgery. And I can absolutely see how this would be really nice for a kid who's going to have surgery and anesthesia to read and kind of get a feel for the fact that this isn't scary and it's kind of can even be fun. So with the support of the community, she's donating books to children's hospitals all over the country. I would definitely check it out. Again, it's called Toby's Magic Bubbles, an anesthesia story, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that book. And kudos to Maria for writing a book while being an anesthesia resident. Very impressive.
Very impressive. That's right? A small feat.
Totally. All right, Tyler, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Jeb.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.